Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice. Mona, you know, we've been doing this show for over 4 years, well over 100 episodes, but I was thinking, it got me wondering, how long have you been practicing EB5?
Good question. Here comes the age. No, seriously, I've been doing EB5 for a lot longer than that, as I keep telling you. We first looked into it around about 2006 and really got going around about, say, 2007, 2008. But I have to say that there's been such a huge difference. There weren't really rules back in 2007 as to what a developer should and shouldn't do. Nobody had even heard of securities laws. Time has shown us, well, you know how changed that has been. Mm-hmm. But when we first started to actually think about securities laws and what a developer should and shouldn't do, you know who was out there at that time? The name? It was Michael Hohmeyer. And guess what?
What, Mona?
Really? Really, Mark?
The listener's laughing because, of course, we have. Who do we have, Mona?
Yeah, we have Michael Hohmeyer because guess what? Now in 2020, who's one of the biggest names on the securities and what a developer should and shouldn't do market? It's Michael.
It's Michael Hohmeyer. That's right. Michael has practiced law for over 3 decades and has had a particular focus on EB5 in the last 11 years or so with over 400 EB5 matters he's worked on. He's represented a large number of regional centers and security issuers in the EB5 program and assisted them with structuring of their projects, as well as some of the negotiating and drafting of the corporate and securities documents, as you were alluding to earlier, Mona, which makes him an ideal guest for today's show and today's topic. We're going to dive into an insider's look at the advice EB5 developers receive.
Sounds good to me. I'm thrilled to be with you both.
Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming on the show. No, seriously, you were the person we always reached out to back in those days. And of course, we've learned a lot because there has been such a huge, EB5 really has evolved, especially in this area.
Yes, it has. There has been huge progress made. There have been bumps in the road that folks have had to get over. Most of those bumps, I think, have come about because of, well, some of them have been bad behavior on the part of some bad intentioned folks. But for the most part, there's that lack of information. And yeah. I think your work here on these podcasts is a great tool to help and correct that. Get information out to people, whatever their role may be. People who are just interested in EB5, they've heard about it, they want to know more. Folks who are trying to raise funding in the area, folks from overseas who are looking to try to make their dream of coming to the U.S. true by seeking and securing an EB5 immigration visa. It's all about getting information out to folks so that they can understand better what it is they're getting into, whether it's right for them or not, whether this capital is correct for them to add to their capital stack if they're on the developer side. So this is all great information. It's a wonderful opportunity I'm thrilled to have. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And you know, when we were thinking about this topic, it's a little inverted because the topic is an insider's look at the advice EB5 developers receive. It's really aimed for the consumer. It's really aimed for the investor because an investor really doesn't know what a developer is advised unless they go to somebody like yourself or really unless they've really gone through some of the issues. And a lot of developers don't do it the right way, as we know.
Sadly, that's true. But the securities law responsibilities are imposed on the U.S. business that's looking to raise the money, not on the investors, whether they're overseas investors or domestic investors. So we securities lawyers are almost always working for the issuer or the developer or the EB5 funding company that's going to raise the money, as opposed to representing the investors. And so investors often don't get the opportunity to understand what sort of information disclosure do the securities laws require and what sorts of things then should they be looking for in trying to decide whether or not this is a transparent deal that's been presented to them that not only makes sense based on what they've been told, but is likely to include being told everything that there is to be told in order to make an informed investment decision. So in that sense, this is a great tool for investors who we securities lawyers usually don't work directly for to get a better understanding of what it is that the developers are needing to comply with in getting information out to prospective investors.
Well, exactly. You know, there was something when we were chatting that you mentioned, and I think it's a good idea to state it for our listeners. People often ask for an EB-5 securities lawyer. And as you mentioned earlier, securities law is securities law. What makes you different to, say, any other securities law firm?
I think a couple of things. One is deep experience, over 400 projects that my firm and I, and now as a solo again, have worked on over 11 years of time. People have asked questions, what is the best EB-5 team, or who are the best EB-5 people, or what's the best EB-5 project? And I think at the end of the day, it all involves how much experience do people have on the business side of things. Obviously not the investors. They're looking to do this once and hopefully never have to do it again.
Yeah.
But the businesses are hoping to do it more than once. Yes. And EB-5 can be a repeat source of funding for businesses large and even small, so that everybody needs to be looking to find the most experienced group of people that they can find to work with. That's why we're seeing over the years that you and I have both been involved in practice, the people who are still here at the top of the game are here while those with less experience who may not be as serious are gone. As economic circumstances have gotten more difficult, EB-5 has become more challenging. And we're left with the people really at the top of the game with the most experience, who are the ones that both developers and investors should be looking to in saying, well, these are the best folks to work with and probably have the most fully transparent and best described investment opportunities. It doesn't mean those are the best investments.
Right.
But it does mean that when you sit down to read something, you're probably getting the full picture for better or for worse.
Right.
So that, and the securities laws require that that picture be presented warts and all. Not only what's the upside that everybody hopes happy will get accomplished, but also what are the risks and how serious are those risks? And those risks, it's essential that they be disclosed by the business, because the government out to protect investors, not the businesses that are trying to get money from them, but the government exists to protect investors, whether they're U.S. investors or foreign investors, and whether those foreign investors are looking to become Americans one day or not. Even if they plan on never coming to the States, but they want to invest in a U.S. business, the securities laws are disclosure obligations that are imposed on the business for the benefit of the investors.
Right. That's very important, because there's two elements which often people forget to any project or to any EB-5 project. And one is that you are investing in a business.
Yes.
So, Michael, this is what we're going to do today. We're going to move in a little different way than our normal way. Mark and I have got some real questions from developers, and some of them are really sort of difficult type of questions. And we're going to pose them to you as if we are coming to you and asking your advice. And we want you to respond as if we are the developer. And, you know, this is the advice that you would give.
Yes.
Ready, Mark?
I'm ready.
All right. I'm going to come with the first question. Michael, EB-5 is a business. Things happen. We need to change me, the developer, pretending to be the developer. We need to change the management. And I also need to sell off part of the assets, which I had promised my investors would remain part of the collateral. Do I have to tell them if I do sell off the assets? Do I have to tell anybody if I change the management?
Here's the commonplace lawyer response. It depends. As always, it depends on timing, on where things are in the process. Is this a brand new investment? Is it an investment that is still being offered? Have investors partially or some investors already come in and invested and others are still being solicited? Is it an investment that is closed and now people are have gotten the business funded and they're attempting to execute the business plan?
Let's take it both ways.
Sure.
Let's start, first of all, it's still being funded. So we wanted 20 investors. We've got 10. We've got another 10 to get. And we're okay. We've got some bridge financing, which will keep us going. So I want to change the management and I want to sell off some of the assets.
So the reason timing is so important is exactly for this scenario that you're laying out. Once the deal is done, the raise has closed, and all of the money and all of the investors are in, everything is cast in concrete. It suddenly gets put in the oven, it's baked, it's done. You can't change it without going through, jumping through an awful lot of hoops and probably getting investor consent to making changes in those areas where a developer and his lawyer didn't have enough foresight ahead of time to build in flexibility. And it's often difficult to have flexibility, too much flexibility, without making things so mushy that you're not really disclosing what your plan is and your roadmap for how you're going to carry out the investment in the future. While the offering is still ongoing, even if investors have subscribed, it is possible still to make changes, to propose that to the new investors and say the deal has now changed. This is what, these are the new investment circumstances. And also, probably it's legally required under the securities laws to go back to the investors who have already signed up and say, we need to tell you too that the deal has changed. We need to give you something technically called rescission rights, where we have to tell you about the changes and you get an opportunity to either say, I'm still in despite those changes, or I don't like those changes. This isn't the deal for me anymore.
But I don't want to do that, Michael. I don't want to go back to my existing investors and give them the right of rescission, because that means I would have to give them the right to be able to take their money back.
Well, the securities laws don't really care what a business would prefer. Unfortunately, the government says, remember, these laws exist to protect the investors. Yes. And they require that the businesses comply with disclosure obligations to tell investors, this is what you're getting into. And when the business finds out halfway through that what it is offering to investors is different than what it said it was going to be, the only way for the business to not later, be after everything set in concrete, get called on the carpet for having lied or misstated or at worst been negligent in describing the circumstances of the investment, they've got to tell the investors, hey, the deal has changed.
But what if I'm the regional center and the developer decides he's going to do that and the developer doesn't tell me, the regional center? Then what do I do? Am I still bound as a regional center? Do I get into trouble?
Yeah, again, it depends on what is the contract between the regional center and the issuer. If that issuer is the developer and he's wearing two hats, then the regional center has to decide whether or not to go along with the changed circumstances or whether it has the power to require that changes be disclosed or that the deal not be changed. That depends upon what's the contract that was entered into. And almost always the contract has already been entered into before the offering goes out to the public. So if the regional center is smart, they'll work with experienced counsel, both immigration counsel and securities counsel, and make sure that the deal they make with the developer gives the regional center the flexibility to say, this is the deal I'm going to sponsor you for. If you change this deal materially, I have the opportunity to say good or not good. I'm out. This is not the deal. These are not the droids I'm looking for. Okay. I'm out of this deal. And the developer may say, I want the flexibility to make some reasonable changes to this project from what it was when we signed up.
Yeah.
So that way you avoid people not having the flexibility to deal with changed circumstances as they come up.
Mark, you have a question?
Thanks, Mona. I do have a couple questions. And I know we're already halfway through this episode already. We've only covered the first one, right?
I think, Michael, you'll have to come on again.
So what I'm going to do is, this is a long question. I'm basically going to paraphrase this and kind of throw my own spin in it for, I guess, more short, directed answers. And that is, Michael, how can developers identify the right regional centers for them? They don't want to start a regional center. They perhaps want to work with one or rent a regional center. What are some of the top two or three things that you think developers should look for in a regional center?
That's a good question, Mark.
Well, it was a really long question I had that someone wrote on the internet. I was like, let's paraphrase this.
I'll tell you why that's a really good question for Michael to answer, because what we are seeing right now and what we've been discussing on our podcast as well is the amount of NOITs which are being issued lately, the notice of intention to terminate. So there's a lot of regional centers which are actually going out of business. So Michael, go ahead.
Honestly, I would tell you that the first and the second and the third answer to that question is the same. It's experience. Nothing substitutes for experience in the EB-5 industry.
Let's explore that. What are some of the elements of experience people should look for? Just the date that it started, the team, for experience?
Great question. It isn't just the date started. It's how many projects has the regional center been involved in? How have they gone? How far have they gone? I mean, were they successfully raised? Did they raise 100% of the capital they were looking to raise? If not, why not? How has the project gone since funding was brought in? Where in the life cycle of the EB-5 project is it? Is it at the end? Is it done and past history? Is it at the very beginning? You want to know what the regional center has seen and how it has participated. You want to know what the regional center has said no to as much as what it has said yes to and why. What were the things that spooked RC from saying yes? If it's not just money, and it shouldn't be just money, it's not about the most money. The regional center, don't forget, has a life separate from any individual project. And if a project gets in trouble, the regional center can get blamed.
Yeah.
And the regional center wants to sponsor projects all over the place, perhaps, if it's not just working for one company. And that it can suffer serious damage if it chooses poorly.
I like that advice. So it's not just the qualitative sum of all the individual elements, the number of projects, the number of investors, the number of 529 approvals and and everything else, but it's also that qualitative piece of what kind of projects do you say no to? And if they hum and haw like, well, we don't know, because if your check clears, we don't say no. But if they're quick to answer that, like, oh, we say no to the following types of projects, maybe that helps you go with this. Thank you for that, Michael.
You bet.
I have a question for you, Michael, which is very much for today's time. You know, we're post-COVID. We're not really post-COVID at all. We are still very much within COVID. But I'm looking a little ahead, and I'm looking to see that, you know, businesses are not doing so well, especially hospitality. So I'm a developer again. My business is in trouble, and we are way beyond getting investors. We have investors in the project. The investors are close on getting their I-829s. After the I-829s, we have to pay the investors back. And I don't see how our business can pay the investors back. So I've come to you and I'm asking you, how do I change our loan documents so that I can postpone paying the EB-5 investor, even though I do have the money right now, but I'd rather use that money for something else?
It's the same answer as before. It depends on when this happens. Because once the offering is closed, the documents in the form that they were in at that moment are now cast in concrete, and they cannot usually be changed unless the developer and the attorneys working for the developer were smart enough to build in some flexibility that gives discretion to the developer to make some changes. Usually there's a practical limit on how much discretion the developer can retain. Because eventually, if a developer retains too much discretion, the investors get nervous that he's going to be able to make all sorts of changes that they will have no voice in. At the same time, on the other hand, you can have a developer who has absolutely no discretion whatsoever. And if the documents say whatever they say, and if you're down the road and you don't have the right under the documents as written, then the developer really doesn't have any choice. He's got to do what he committed to do. And if he wants to do something different, he's going to have to take his hat in hand or hers and go to the investors and say, hello, I need to request that you agree to make a change. And the change is not my fault. It's due to this unexpected circumstance. In this case, it could be this pandemic or the economic consequences to it or government overreaction or underreaction to it. In any event, these changed circumstances, which we didn't know about and didn't anticipate, and it wasn't reasonable for us to have anticipated at the beginning, are now here. We are proposing something we believe is reasonable. We need your consent. That is happening a lot now.
And it is happening. It is happening a lot. And Michael, I have a question.
Yes.
How would your advice change if it was a loan? I can understand that's what you would do. You would go back and ask to change the loan documents. But how would your advice change if it was preferred equity? If each investor had an equitable contribution, which is what we see, the structure we see in many of these projects.
Again, the way to change a deal is if both sides agree. So whether it's an equity deal or a debt deal, if one side feels it has a need to make changes, they can go and request that the other side agree if they don't have the power to unilaterally make the changes on their own. It's the same thing, whether it's equity or debt. The likely reception could be different depending upon if this is a one or two investor deal as opposed to a 50 investor deal where you have to get an awful lot more people to agree. But the overarching rule is going to be the same. If you don't have the ability to change things on your own, and oftentimes there is some flexibility that we attorneys try to build in without going overboard. If there isn't that flexibility built in, then you can make a change if both sides will agree to it.
Yeah, but well, the quality of documents has changed a lot over the past few years now that we've seen litigation and stuff. But I doubt very much that many people would have put in any language relating to a pandemic.
Very true. They may have put in act of God language or force majeure, which means basically unanticipated circumstances beyond anyone's control. And the reaction to the pandemic is viewed as coming within that phrase. Lawyers, typically good business transactional lawyers, securities lawyers, will include wording dealing with unexpected circumstances that are beyond the ability or responsibility to cause of the developer. That doesn't mean that the developer gets to escape dealing with the consequences of something that he didn't cause. And again, if he doesn't have the flexibility to deal with what he feels he has to deal with, he's going to have to propose it. And a lot of projects are saying, you know, if it wasn't for this darn illness going around the world, we wouldn't be willing to make a change that prejudices us, the investors. But we will here because we know if we don't say yes and try to cooperate with the developer in saving the day here, we're all going to sink if this thing hits the iceberg and goes down.
Yes, but I, as the developer, I'm asking you, Michael Hohmeyer, that isn't the EB-5 an at-risk investment? And
of course,
I don't have the money, then I can't pay them back. So why am I asking for their permission? Why can't I just tell them that, look, I don't have the money. You can't have it yet.
Well, it depends, again, on what was the commitment that you made to them at the time that you made the deal. There is no excuse to not honor a commitment that was made without there being legal liability for it. Remember, while the PPM, the private placement memorandum or the offering circular, is a disclosure document and it is not a contract, it just puts together information from various documents in one place and tries to present it to a reader, an investor, all of the other agreements in an EB-5 offering are going to be contracts. The subscription agreement is a contract. The limited partnership agreement or the LLC agreement is a contract. And in those contracts, the developer is saying to the investor, I promise to do this for you and to not do that for you. And the investor is saying, I promise to give you my money and I promise to do this. And so those exchange of promises, we're back to contract law. And if somebody doesn't honor their promises, the other side has the right to pursue legal action against them for breach of contract.
Right. Well, we have seen some litigation out there. And what I have seen thus far, though, is the reaction of, for example, some of the federal judges who've said, at the end of the day, it's an at-risk and investment. And people, you know, you're a big boy if you've put this money in, and you should know what kind of project you've done. So isn't there an element of due diligence beforehand?
Yes, of course there is. And that's the whole purpose of the securities laws existing, to force the business before it takes people's money to tell them what they're getting into. And the more you tell people, the better informed of the decision they make and the more protection they get because of that, and also the developer. So remember, the PPM protects the investors, and by protecting investors, the developer is protecting himself as well. But
you know, Michael, that's a very interesting point, because there are many a time people have said to me, I don't want to pay the extra legal fee in getting a PPM. I don't think I need it. And I think that that's a huge argument against that, because yes, you need it to protect yourself.
Absolutely. And remember that issuers of securities in EB-5 and out are held to the same standard. They have got to honor the deal that they made, do what it is they said they would do, not do what they said they would not do. And they need then, after the offering and the money has been raised, they have converted their investors into shareholders, whether they're called limited partners or LLC members, doesn't matter the lingo. The concept is the same. These people are their shareholders. And under the law of every state, businesses owe obligations, duties to their shareholders, to fiduciary duties, to deal fairly with them, to deal with loyalty, to take care. That doesn't mean that that requires a developer to roll over and not consider its own interests, but not to consider only its own interests, but also the investors. And so the investors have both contract rights and fiduciary duty protection under law, which may not be in the contract, but are certainly protecting them under the law of each state that they're investing in.
So, Michael, the other thing that we are seeing, and I'm sure you are seeing a lot of this as well, are investors who want to withdraw because of maybe the time, or maybe they need that money and they don't really want to keep their money here anymore. And as well as that, there are so many denials that USCIS are doing right now. So they're asking for their money back prior to the term. And if a developer is in a situation whereby if he repays one person, that would really hurt the rest of the project because the project's not ready for the money to be released yet. What is your advice in that scenario?
It's the same answer as before. It depends on what the documents say. Carefully written documents will tell investors, warning, you will not be repaid early, no matter what the reason. And if that wording is in that deal, and that investor's not comfortable with that, he ought not to make the investment.
But what if the wording is not there? Is not the point of the fiduciary duty is the fact that the fiduciary duty overplays any wording?
No, it doesn't. As a matter of fact, it's not a violation of the fiduciary duty to stand on the developer, standing on language that says, I have no obligation to repay you early until the time for ending the investment has occurred. If it hasn't occurred yet, I'm sorry if your circumstances are such that you personally need the money. Not only am I contractually unable to pay you, I would be breaching the contract if I broke the wording and gave you money back early.
This is a really important point because we are seeing a lot of litigation in precisely this field, a lot with the Chinese who don't want to wait 15 years.
Oh, I don't blame them. But you know what? You don't want to say tough. That's never the right thing to say. But people have to understand, and this is why I think your podcast and getting information out to people, which is what we started with, is so important. If people know that not only developers, but investors, they're going to be held to the contract they signed to, then they shouldn't expect to be given some special dispensation that goes against the wording that they signed up to. And if they don't like the wording or if it worries them or concerns them at the beginning, that's the time to make the better informed decision not to invest in that project. I will warn them, though, the vast majority of developers are going to have contracts that say the same thing. Don't expect us to repay you. Almost certainly we will not want to or be unable to do so because of whatever reason. And so this is a disclosure we're making to you up front as required by law.
Can a developer, even if he's a managing member, change the contracts?
Almost certainly not, unless in the rare case there's wording that allows him to do so. The only time he can change the contract is before it is signed by the other side, the investor.
Yeah, it sounds like that's one of the reasons why there's been such a huge rise in these EB-5 escrow accounts and escrow companies and these third-party banks that basically hold the money, review the contracts unilaterally and independent of developers, regional centers, and investors, and then make the decisions themselves.
Well, usually at this point, the money has been released, Mark. These are all actual instances which are happening today because we are hearing them all the time now. For example, there are big projects. I don't want to name them on this particular. For example, there are big projects which are shaking right now because of COVID. And there's investors who are asking, can we just take our money back now? Can we just take it out of sequence? We don't care. We don't want the EB-5 anymore. We want our money back. Mm. You know, or perhaps they've been denied and they want their money back because they've been denied. So there are different angles. Mm.
This is why it's so important to get the documents right at the beginning.
Yeah.
So that the issuer is offering the deal he really can stand behind, and the investors understand exactly what it is they're getting into, both good and risky, so that people later on can't say, oh, I'm surprised.
Michael, we could talk for a couple of hours, I think.
Indeed.
We have to come back because we've only hit two questions on my list, and I have a whole lot of more questions here. So please do come back on our show.
It would be my pleasure, Mona.
Yes, Michael Hohmeyer, thank you so much for coming on EB-5 Investment Voice.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.